Tao, unity, complementarity, triadness. The triadness has the fulsomeness of the Tao. Is not a representation of the Tao, but is a presentation of it, and so has that fruitfulness. What does the triadness produce? Lao Tzu uses the Chinese phrase, which is two characters. The first character means putting 10,000, and the second character means things. And when the Chinese use this character, it doesn't mean 10,000 things. It means unlimited. We would use, in a philosophic sense in our time, the term infinity. But we would use, in a rhetorical sense in our time, multiplicity. The triadness produces the multiplicity of the world, the infinity of the universe. I'm using language carefully here for you. The multiplicity of the world, the infinity of the universe. Now, in terms of a Pythagorean Taoist number designation, you have an interesting kind of a progression. You have the progression. George Gamow wrote a book in the 50s called 1, 2, 3 Infinity. It's a marvelous book at that time, very influential. I was a head porter at Sequoia National Park, and Gamow used to come up every year with his wife and his little convertible sports car and his European luggage and his big jovial self and just talk about the universe as if it were like next door. And you really got the sense that man could be free in thinking about the whole, of all of it. You don't have to, with tremulous little crutches, hope that you can get to the top at the last gasp, like Roger Bannister running the mile under 4 minutes and then collapsing at the finish. You don't have to do that. You can cruise effortlessly to the top and back and to the top and back. There's no problem whatsoever. But Lao Tzu adds the zero base to Gamow's beautiful phrase, 0, 1, 2, 3, infinity. And when you have that, when you have that five-phase energy cycle, the infinity is factorable without remainder into the zero. And that's where reality gains its tremendous dynamic and power. Unheard of power. It's the power of infinity being factored without remainder into zero. And that's why zero can produce the unity. It has that power. It has all the power there is. So that in the 42nd chapter of the Tao Te Ching, about 500 BC, you have the classic Chinese understanding that this five-part energy cycle is an ecology of the structure of the real. That same understanding, not just similar, but that same understanding obtains in India, and the first classical source of that is the Taittiriya Upanishad, which I spoke on at the PRS Thursday night. The same five-part structure was the hermetic understanding of the alchemical ecology, and the quintessence, the fifth essence, was that zero that shows, links all of it together, links the 1, 2, 3 infinity together with, the colloquial phrase was, the unseen. One more point and then we'll take a break. That hermetic structure was rediscovered in the Renaissance. Or let's put it stronger. The rediscovery of that made the Renaissance. The rediscovery of that made the Renaissance. It was rediscovered in the 13th century by a handful of individuals. I mean a handful. Less than five. And was squelched. And was rediscovered again, a second time, in the 15th century, but was unable to be squelched. Because the second time, there was a masterful person who had enough money to buy his own armies to protect his own philosophers, Cosimo de' Medici. And at that time, instead of just a few alchemical magicians like Roger Bacon or Michael Scott or Raymond Lull understanding, Cosimo de' Medici commissioned Ficino to translate all of the Hermetic documents that could be found in the world at that time. And they were all translated by 1453 into Latin. They were difficult to read in Greek, but in Latin there were thousands of people that could read them. And that was the basis of the Renaissance. The difference between Florence in the 1440s and Florence in the 1460s, 20 years, is an asymptotic jump in the human confidence that we can understand who we are and what we do. And we don't have to, with shakiness, manipulate appearances and foist that onto nature, but we can do real things that resonate with the universe in an actual way. And the Renaissance comes out of that. I mean the Renaissance where you could look at somebody like Michelangelo or Leonardo da Vinci or Lorenzo de' Medici, and you had human beings who were just amazingly full and capacious. That Renaissance, that second Renaissance, reverberated through European society, through European civilization, through the geography of Europe. And the last place that rang with that was England. England was the last place where the glory of the Renaissance understanding of the Hermetic mode rang. And the highest mountain in England was the mind of Shakespeare. And Shakespeare, by the time he was 30 years old, was just, I think we would use the term, and his contemporaries would have used the term, he was gorgeous. After he died, his friend Ben Jonson wrote a foreword to to one of the plays, The Troilus and Cressida, and he said, "Herein you will find more wit than you have brain to grind it upon." When Shakespeare was 30 years old, when he had just come into his own, and he was like golden with the light of the Renaissance, the rediscovery of the Hermetic tradition, a very, very important marriage took place, January 26, 1595, and he was commissioned to write a play for that marriage, and that play is A Midsummer Night's Dream. And in A Midsummer Night's Dream, the structure that Shakespeare put in is the five-phase energy cycle. It has five acts. And it's just like moving through the whole Hermetic understanding of the quintessence. And so A Midsummer Night's Dream, critics have said, well, we can't be sure of where he got the ideas for this. Well, he got it from his deep self, alive in a universe that was understandable. Let's take a break and we'll come back. What are you doing on our groups? Our alchemical studies groups. Let's say the first group is on the essay in alchemical studies on the secret of the golden flower, and that's Sina and Robert and Dolores. How are you? Do you have the volume? Do you
have the volume.
You have the volume?
I'm starting, but...
Okay, but you've got the volume and you're conscious of the fact that the three of you are going to do this. Okay.
We are doing some reading. And I think
it's all you need. It's all you need is just to... I like to know that you're stirring and that you're conscious that you're stirring together. Yes, you will. You will. That's fine. Be sure and bring that out. Yeah.
Vividly.
Vividly. There are many different kinds of Taoists. There are different Taoist lineages. My mentor was a Maoshan Taoist, like Master Ni. They're from the same region of China. They would have understood each other just like that. So when I took my degree in Chinese to Master Ni, he said, well, you have my permission to use my teachings in any way you wish. But if someone comes from a different district, they're from around Nanjing, that region of China. If one comes from up by Beijing in the Western Hills, Richard Wilhelm's mentor was a Taoist from that region. Is a different lineage, and he was taught in a certain way. Jung had no lineage, no Taoist lineage. He learned from Wilhelm, but he learned secondhand from Wilhelm from that kind of a tradition. So there are many different ways. Many, it's complicated. In order to keep the lineages right, the master is given the family chart. If you're able to get into a position, Master Ni could bring out of a drawer and lay out on the desk the long family chart that goes back 76 generations. Every name is there. And if you want to go to Nitsan in the 13th century, there he is. There's how it was passed on. There's who he got it from. There's what he did with it. And the whole thing is there. It's like a mnemonic. And without that history, you wouldn't be able to keep the transpersonal structure of the lineage in focus. So there are differences. But do the best we can. Jung did the very best he could. One great thing about Jung is his honesty. He gives you 100%, and that's all that you can ask from a person. If you look at the index, Volume 20 of the Collected Works, you can see there are not many references to China outside of the Secret of the Golden Flower at all. The commentary on the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the commentary on the Secret of the Golden Flower. I think he did a introductory commentary for Dichi Suzuki's Introduction to Zen Buddhism, but there isn't much. He didn't have the background. He had a European background with Schopenhauer and Kant and so forth. And so there's a lot of limitations that he has. But he's, as far as he goes, he's trustworthy. You can count the people on one hand that have a legitimate Taoist background in this country. And that's it. One of them is my friend Kai Di, who when he went to China a couple of years ago, went to the White Cloud Monastery outside of Beijing, and they conferred on him, because it was the first time that they were able to do this publicly in China, they conferred on him all of the degrees and the accoutrements and so forth, so that he's legitimate Taoist master, which he is. They're very, very legitimate. And then there's Master Ni, and then there aren't many others at all. There are a lot of gym teachers disguising themselves as Taoists. There's a world of difference. It's like somebody buys a play of Shakespeare and says, well, I'm an Elizabethan specialist. Are you? Okay, the second is the vision of Zosimus. This is Carol and Jerry and Donna. And the three of you are aware that you're just you're reading in the vision of Zosimus, and you're going to talk together, and you're going to, at some time, 6-8 weeks down the line, let us know what that little essay is about in your readings. Okay? And Paracelsus is Molly and Don.
I asked to be part of the spirit
materials. It's Dan.
Dan it is. All right, good. Well, then you people are more together than my list. Dan, I'm spelling your name in such a way that it looks like Don, sorry.
Everybody does. I answer to Don as often as to Dan. It's close.
Well, you and Molly are aware of this, and then when Gustavo and Sylvia get back next week from Buenos Aires, I'll put them together with you so there'll be four of you. Gustavo's capable and Sylvia's lovable, and that'll work out. With four of you, you'll be able to do that all right. Don, you're down for the spirit Mercurius with Lois and Linda. So the three of you are aware that you're working together. And the philosophical tree has five people, Chris and Ed and Jennifer and Walter. And Toshi, who seems not to be coming, thinking that you can follow it by tape. You can't follow a real process by tape. Tapes are all right, but it's negligible in terms of the real experience. If you listen to the tape, you can get what I say, but you don't have your experience. Your experience is a reaction to the tape. But here, your experience is legitimate. And if I do it right, your deep self will come into play. So you're doing the philosophical tree, and you're aware that this is a tremendous treatise, an essay. I hope that you're aware, the philosophical tree. Notice poignantly that there is a difference between taking a person as the symbolic center and taking a universal theme as the symbolic center. There's a radical difference. Radical difference. Now, the first person in the Western tradition to write it down and make that radical difference conscious in expressed words was Aristotle. Again, notice you can't throw anything away. Everything is useful. Let me see if I can find, I looked up today the designation. Now, this was an introduction to Aristotle. It passed down as tradition this is a part of the Poetica of Aristotle. And it's in section 1451 of the Poetics of Aristotle. In this edition, it's given section 8, but it's 1451 lines 16 through 35. That's how you generally look up Aristotelian references. Let me just give you what Aristotle writes in this good English translation. This is the Poetics translated here by Ingram Bywater, who was a very likable, Tolkien-esque kind of a scholar at the beginning of the 20s and so forth. The unity of a plot, the Greek term for plot is mythos, the unity of a plot does not consist, as some suppose, in its having one man as its subject. An infinity of things befall that one man, some of which it is impossible to reduce to unity. Isn't that interesting? And in like manner, there are many actions of one man which cannot be made to form one action. Notice that already in the Western tradition, Aristotle would not understand Lao Tzu. Already. This is 340 BC. Already. Whereas someone like Heraclitus or Socrates would have understood immediately. One sees, therefore, the mistake of all the poets who have written an epic like the Theseid or the Heraclid or similar poems. They suppose that because Heracles was one man, the story also of Heracles must be one story. Homer, however, evidently understood this point quite well, whether by art or instinct, just as, in the same way, he excels the rest in every other respect. In writing an Odyssey, he did not make the poem cover all that ever befell his hero. For instance, it befell Odysseus to get wounded on Parnassus, and also to feign madness at the time of the call to arms. But the two incidents had no necessary or probable connection with one another. Instead of doing that, he took as the subject of the Odyssey, as also of the Iliad, an action with a unity of the kind we are describing. The truth is that just as in the other imitative arts, one imitation is always of one thing, so in poetry, the story, as an imitation of action, must represent one action, a complete whole, with its several incidents so closely connected that the transposal or withdrawal of any one of them will disjoin and dislocate the whole. For that which makes no perceptible difference by its presence or absence is no real part of the whole. That in Aristotle's Poetics, and as you can see already, the Poetics of Aristotle, 340 or 350 BC, are already introducing a problematic which is like a flat note that goes all the way through Western civilization. But if one is conscious, if one is aware of this, if one has learned about this, you can use that information and save yourself an awful lot of misunderstanding. I'm saying to you, you have to not just accept prima facie the culture and civilization that you are handed. It's flawed. Not all of it, but a great deal of it. And especially in the way in which you are expected to subconsciously respond to it, is totally flawed. Now, in the Renaissance, the ideal was of the radiant self, the whole person, the radiant self. By the 20th century, there was no confidence at all in the radiant self. There was every kind of suspicion that the unconscious was a demonic level, lurking to snare you, trap you. The id, shit. You know, it's like that. So, excuse me. But I have to teach you so you understand. It's this kind of reductionism. It's this kind of confidence in appearances, which is misleading for us. You can have confidence in your expression of the appearances, but to have confidence in the appearances without being conscious of the expression of them is very, very dangerous. A great actor who delivers King Lear to you is a fantastic person. Someone who gets lost and is Lear-like is a hell of a mess. And there's just that difference between what we would call madness and what we would call human excellence. It's a threshold of awareness raised to the level of consciousness and become practical as an art, the Greek word techne. Let me pursue this just one instance further. Let's stay with Aristotle for a moment. One of the very nicest classical scholars who was at the University of Toronto years and years ago, 30, 40 years ago, Grube, G.M.A. Grube, did a little selection on Aristotle on poetry and style, selections from the Poetics and the Rhetoric, and published in the Library of Liberal Arts. Used to be available in the blue bindings or the yellow bindings, and now they have magenta bindings. His little note on selections from Aristotle's Rhetoric, just a paragraph or two from his note, introductory note, puts you in the driver's seat. Plato had said that if rhetoric was to be a techne, that is, an art or craft based on special knowledge, if rhetoric was to be an art or craft based on special knowledge, a techne, the speaker or writer should have knowledge of the human soul and its different parts and functions. He should also have a theoretic knowledge. When Plato uses the term theoretic, he doesn't mean approximate. The Greek term thesis means a point of view, a consistent point of view. So that a theoretic knowledge is a very accurate understanding that from this point of view, this is how it looks. From this point of view, this is how it looks. It's not an approximation, it's very accurate. When Plato says theoretic, he means very accurate. One should have a knowledge of the human soul and all of its parts and their functions. And he should also have a theoretical knowledge of the different types of arguments and of their appeal to different kinds of men. Now, the dialogue that this is specified in Plato is the Phaedrus. Aristotle, writes Grube, Aristotle took up this challenge in the first two books of the Rhetoric. Do you understand that Aristotle was a pupil of Plato's for 20 years? He studied under Plato for 20 years. The only reason he stopped studying is that Plato died. Aristotle took up this challenge in the first two books of the Rhetoric. He begins by asserting that rhetoric is a techne. It is an art, the art of rhetoric, which in our time has been completely lost. No one understands this. Very few people understand this. And establishes the formula. Aristotle establishes the formula in his book, The Rhetoric, Of the three types of rhetoric which was universally adopted later, everywhere that Greek culture spread, including the Roman Empire, everywhere, this has been adopted. Three types are, the first is the political or the deliberative political rhetoric. The second is the forensic, and the third is the epideic oratory of display, epideic, epideic oratory of display. He then proceeds to an analysis of human goods and the external circumstances of human life, which the orator must know. In the second book, he deals with human emotions, such as anger, fear, pity, indignation, etc., the different characteristics of youth, middle age, old age, and the various ways men react to power, the way they react to wealth, and so on. You can see Aristotle is very complete. He's a great student. Everything all out. Having done this, he goes on to a study of commonplaces upon which arguments are based, and analyzes different kinds of proof, different kinds of refutation, and the Greek word is enthymema, the reasoning form from probable premises, which is to rhetoric what the syllogism is to philosophy. Now, I have to give you a line from the beginning of the rhetoric so you can understand that there's a structural relationship here. This is how the rhetoric of Aristotle begins. The first sentence is, rhetoric is the counterpart of dialectic. Now, for all intents and purposes, dialectic to you should connotate logic. So that rhetoric and logic go together. It's like dialectic or logic is the structure of structure, and rhetoric is the structure of content. So they go together. It's not just that they go together in Aristotle's book and in the Western tradition, but in fact, in the way that language functions in human experience, they go together. Rhetoric and logic go together. So that in logic, you have a counterpart in rhetoric, and in rhetoric, you have a counterpart in logic. All languages display this feature. I guess that's the correct way to say that. All languages display this characteristic feature better. Now, if you put that insight into our major differentiation, that language in a feeling mode is mythic, and language in a thinking mode is magical. A mythic language is different from a magical language. In the mythic language, it's the image base that's emphasized. In a thinking language, it's the symbolic mode that's emphasized. The coherence of a feeling structure based on images is the essential nature, structure of a myth. The myth, the plot line, how it hangs together. But in language as a magical language, the psychic use of magic, language, psychic energy put into language, magical languages, use a symbolic structure so that rhetoric and logic function in a certain way in the mythic horizon, and they function differently from that in consciousness, in thought, in the thinking horizon. In thought, the logical part, the dialectic part, becomes emphasized at the expense of the rhetorical. Just as in myth, the rhetorical side is emphasized at the expense of the dialectic or logical. They never quite disappear, but in the one or the other, the counterpart is atrophied by disuse, atrophied by disuse to the extent that it seems to be subconscious. So that on a mythic level, human beings don't pay much attention to logic. And on a thought level, human beings don't pay too much attention to feeling. But they always go together. They're always there together. So that when you come to understand or try to understand yourself, the misuse of language in its fullness is always a barrier to you. It always gets in your way. It's always an obstacle. And when the mind tries to recognize the true nature, it's almost functionally illiterate one way or the other. This is why in the Indian tradition, in the Indian tradition, mind is placed in the center of the five-part energy cycle. The third kosha, the third sheath, is the mind. That the mind can comprehend as a whole the second kosha, the second sheath, the realm of vital breath, prana, is a Sanskrit term for that. The mind can comprehend that realm of vital breath, just like vital breath can comprehend the realm of food, natural nourishment food. But the mind cannot comprehend itself. In order to comprehend itself, one has to go to knowledge. One has to go to the structure of the mind, the subtler essence of the mind. One has to go to gnosis in order to understand the mind as a whole. And even that's not the end, because there's a subtlety of, the Western term has always been love. The Indian term has always been bliss. Only bliss can comprehend gnosis. Only love can comprehend the wholeness of understanding, of knowledge. It's like that. So that mind is put in the middle. Now in the Chinese energy cycle, mind would be where duality is. Or we would say today, polarity, but polarity has a connotation of exclusive dichotomy, whereas what is understood in India and in China and in the Western esoteric tradition would be complementarity. So that the mind is characterized, in fact, by complementarity. And a complementarity which is masterful in terms of certain realms of experience, but ineffectual in more subtle realms of experience. So that the mind has to give way to those subtler realms. And it's like in the in the Indian tradition, which is more specific about this sort of thing, the mind has to give way to knowledge. And the essential shape of understanding that knowledge comprehends is the functioning of the mind as a whole. The essential gnosis is that's how the mind works. To be able to step back within yourself and see, this is how the mind works. It always works this way. These are its functions. These are its limitations. These are its excellencies. And other than this, it can't go. And of course, if you have kind of like an egotistical confidence, well, my mind can do anything. Well, but it cannot. It has limitations. It has a shape. And knowledge rests in its excellence of being able to see the shape of the mind. Just as that knowledge must yield to an even subtler comprehension, which we call love, or sometimes you hear in I think in contemporary terms, you hear all sorts of descriptions of it as Christic consciousness, or you know, there are many different terms of that. In India, it's called bliss. Ananda, in the sense that this is ineffably more comprehensive than knowledge is, because it's able to comprehend knowledge as a whole. Knowledge as a whole has a shape also, just like the mind has a shape. Though the shape of love would stagger any imagination. But bliss also, that level, love also has a shape. Who knows this? Only one being knows this, and that is God. God could be literally defined as he who knows the shape of love. And we say, oh, well, this is impossibly subtle. Is that so? Well, one can very easily use a very powerful symbol, which we use next month, Valentine's Day, and say, well, there's the symbol of it. So it's not so very difficult at all, actually. Even though when you speak of it in this way, it sounds so incredibly subtle. How could anyone have even supposed or guessed in wild speculation? But the fact is that in the excellence of the wisdom traditions, there have been people the world round for all time who have been able to set this out in just excellent order all the time. It's only recently that the trust in this and the confidence in this has been scrambled and blurred. And for someone like me, the only thing I can do is to assure you that human wisdom traditions are trustworthy. You can rely on them. It's a royal road. Now, this five-part energy cycle puts the fulcrum, I almost said problematic, but it isn't problematic, puts the fulcrum on the mind, puts the fulcrum on complementarity, on the dynamic which, if it's misunderstood, would be polarity. If you misunderstand it as polarity, you come up with oppositions. Polar oppositions. So that, for instance, when the Pythagorean communities, under the original tutelage of Pythagoras, started someone off, they gave them a list of polarities. Hot and cold, wet and dry. But the ultimate polarity was limited and unlimited. Limited and unlimited is like yin and yang. It's an ultimate polarity which can only be resolved by understanding that they aren't exclusive, but they're complementary. Pythagoras says, the human soul is the ultimate shape of limitation, free within the unlimited. It's a wonderfully beautiful, gorgeous way of talking spiritually, which he could do, apparently so. When this comes down through history, through cultural transformations, comes to us, one of the last places where it is recognizable is in the English Renaissance. The Elizabethan Age is one of the last times that that universal learning and understanding is whole, and it is able to be expressed as a whole by people who had confidence that